From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Earth Firster Judy Barry goes to court in her lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland police, which blamed her for the car bombing that nearly killed her.
Well, I was crippled for life by the bombing. There's no way I can even describe the impact. It completely changed my life. My backbone was shattered and dislocated. I ended up miraculously with only 1 foot paralyzed. I was not expected to walk, but I have extreme nerve damage and I have limited ability to sit, walk, and stand.
The American Public Health Association elects Quentin Young as its new president. We'll have a conversation with the staunch advocate of single-payer health insurance.
Single-payer national health insurance is just that. It organizes, like Social Security or Medicare, government collection of the costs of the program and government payment for it. And in sharp contrast, in running away from government control, we ran into the arms of corporation that gives all doctors and all patients the postgraduate course in control.
And it's the founding convention of the Alliance, a progressive populist movement. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 300 people returning from refugee camps in eastern Zaire were massacred in a church in Burundi. This according to the UN Refugee Agency. A spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees told reporters only sketchy details were available from the October 22nd attack, which recalled the 1994 Tutsi Hutu ethnic slaughter in neighboring Rwanda. The victims, believed to be Burundian Hutus, were among the first refugees to return to Burundi when fighting broke out around refugee camps in eastern Zaire last month. Nearly half the 800 American troops who could take part in any Central African aid mission are already in place. A Pentagon spokesperson says 365 military personnel are in Uganda, Rwanda, and Kenya. Also, some 45 U.S. aircraft are standing by in Europe and Africa to assist in any refugee assistance mission. The Army wants to take a new step to root out sexual misconduct within its ranks. Army Secretary Togo West today plans to announce the formation of a civilian military panel. The group's aim will be to investigate whether the service has a system-wide sexual harassment problem. The move follows charges of rape and sexual harassment at an Army training center in Maryland. While federal officials hailed a $13 million settlement of one of the nation's biggest age discrimination suits, some former workers complained that the amount wasn't nearly enough. The settlement affects about 2,000 former employees of Martin Marietta Corporation, forced out of non-union jobs in a series of cutbacks from 1990 to 1994. Martin Marietta is now part of Lockheed Martin Corporation, the leading U.S. defense contractor. The company admitted no wrongdoing under the settlement announced today by the Equal Opportunity Commission. The deal was tentatively approved by a U.S. district judge. And in other news that involves U.S. military contractors, in spite of protests from its own arms control specialists, the Clinton administration is on the verge of relaxing a two-decade-old federal policy intended to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists and rogue states. The Energy Department will almost certainly recommend that plutonium from dismantled atomic bombs to be used as fuel in civilian nuclear power plants before being discarded with radioactive waste. The decision, which the department is expected to announce next month, would breach a wall between the nation's commercial nuclear reactors and its nuclear weapons establishment that has kept weapons-grade plutonium out of the civilian side to reduce the risk of loss or threat. And this news out of Pennsylvania, the city's pension board in Philadelphia figures Texaco will hardly notice its decision to sell $5.8 million in company stock to protest racial discrimination. "We don't pretend that we're going to have much effect on what happens there," said Chairman Ben Haler after yesterday's vote. But he said there was a very strong feeling we do not want to be doing business with Texaco. Texaco agreed to pay $176 million to settle a discrimination lawsuit after a recording of executives apparently belittling black employees was made public earlier this month. The board, which oversees the pension funds of 60,000 retired and active city workers, voted unanimously to sell its Texaco stock for 1 year, or until Texaco shows genuine improvement in its work climate for female and minority employees. This news from Jerusalem. Yasser Arafat's government will distribute video cameras to Palestinians living near Israeli checkpoints to help them document abuse by Israeli troops. The decision was taken after a Palestinian amateur cameraman filmed two Israeli border policemen as they kicked, beat, and humiliated six Palestinian laborers caught sneaking into Israel. Two policemen were arrested after the tape was broadcast on Israel TV this week. And in our all-too-frequent execution update, a man who raped and suffocated two women days after escaping from a prison work crew was put to death by injection early today, hours after Virginia executed a man convicted of fatally stabbing a woman. Frank Middleton was sentenced to death for the 1984 slaying of Shirley Mae Mack in Charleston. He had escaped while serving a 6-year sentence for stabbing a 13-year-old boy. Before he died, Middleton glanced at reporters and shouted, "I'm going into the promised land." And you're listening to Democracy Now! Earth First pretrial hearing is beginning today. In 1990, a bomb ripped through the car of two Earth First activists who were on their way to an event to save the Redwood Forest. Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney were rushed to the hospital with serious injuries. Instead of conducting a thorough investigation of the attack, the FBI and Oakland police branded Barry and Cherney as terrorists and arrested the two environmentalists for allegedly transporting illegal explosives. Judy Barry is suing the FBI for false arrest, illegal search and seizure, and denial of equal protection of the law. Today, in a federal courtroom in California, the FBI will attempt to strip away at her case by asking the judge to dismiss some of the charges. We're now joined by Judy Barry. Why don't we begin, Judy, by you telling us what this case is all about.
Today we're on our way to a major hearing in our lawsuit against the FBI, and we've been suing the FBI for the last 6 years because back in 1990, while organizing for a nonviolent Earth First logging blockades, I was bombed and nearly killed in a car bomb assassination attempt while driving through Oakland, California. And that was bad enough, but within minutes of the bombing, the FBI appeared on the scene and had me and my companion, Daryl Cherney, who was in the car with me, arrested for possession of the bomb. They said that we were transporting the bomb that was used to try to kill us. So we were arrested as they said that we were terrorists who had blown ourselves up with our own bomb. And they kind of spread this all over the country for the next 8 weeks. They were never able to find any evidence at all to link the bomb to us, and eventually the county refused to prosecute us. But we've never been exonerated. The FBI's never apologized to us, that's for sure. And we're now suing them, Daryl Cherney and I, are suing them for false arrest, illegal search and seizure, unequal protection of the law. And we're suing them on a First Amendment conspiracy charge, claiming that the reason they arrested us for the bombing and pretended that they thought that we were the bombers was to try to violate our right of freedom of speech by discrediting us as terrorists.
I remember at the time that one of the things they said was that the nails that were in this bomb were the same as nails they found in the car that didn't come from the bomb.
And that's very interesting because now that we're bringing this up, the FBI just won't even answer that one straight on. They hedge it. We've been able over the last, well, it's actually 5 years because it takes a year to file the case. Over the last 5 years that we've been pursuing this, we've been able to look at the evidence and get all the files and question them all under oath. And what we've been able to learn is that the nails that were in the bomb were used for shrapnel effect. Those nails were finishing nails, and there were nails in a bag in my car. I used to work as a carpenter. Those nails were roofing nails, and these are two kinds of nails that don't even vaguely look alike, but it says in the warrant that the nails in the bag are identical to the nails in the bomb, and that's one of the points that will be brought up in court today. And let me tell you some of the other ones. That what's going on in court, actually, this is not the full hearing yet. That is, believe it or not, we're not even up to the full hearing. This is another pretrial thing, but it kind of comes down to we have to present the core of our case. We've been in what's called the discovery process for years now, and that's where we collect their testimony, their sworn testimony, and their files. Now that we have all the information, the FBI has made a motion asking the court to dismiss our claim that the search warrant was illegal. And in order to win, all they have to show is that a reasonable officer could have thought that we bombed ourselves, and we have to show that they deliberately lied. But the evidence is so strong that we feel confident that we can. Not only the nails that I just talked about a minute ago that you asked about, But also the main one in the warrant, what it says is that the bomb in my car, it says Special Agent Frank Doyle of the FBI, says that the bomb in my car was on the located on the rear seat floorboard behind the driver's seat, and therefore we should have seen it, and therefore we knew we were carrying it. Well, we have, not only do we have the FBI and Oakland Police's own photos of the bombed car, which clearly show that the front seat is blown right through, the back seat is pristine, it's untouched, and there's a giant hole in the car right under the front seat. So the fact, no honest observer could have thought that that bomb was in the back seat. But we also have the testimony of the FBI's own lab expert, who says that not only was the bomb hidden completely under my car seat and that this was obvious from the physical evidence, but he's also testified under oath that this bomb was triggered by a motion device, by a ball bearing that had to roll to connect two contact points. So the idea of a motion-triggered bomb hidden under my car seat certainly undermines their claim that a reasonable officer would have thought that I was anything but the victim of this bomb.
Judy, you mentioned a search warrant. This is a search warrant for your car or for your home?
This is a search warrant for my home. It was a warrantless arrest. They arrested me within 3 hours of the time the bomb went off, and they arrested Daryl within 12 hours. And they did it so quickly, they never wrote out an arrest warrant at all. So the search warrant for our homes contains the causes for the arrest.
You were in the hospital then, weren't you?
I was unconscious. I was close to death. And when I woke up, the first thing I saw was two Oakland police trying to question me without a lawyer. They also, while I was in the hospital, in traction with my pelvis shattered, absolutely immobile, they raised my bail to $100,000, and they claimed on the bail enhancement form, it's called, they claimed that I was a flight risk and a danger to the public.
Presumably, at this time, if you didn't do this yourselves, there was someone or some group of people out there who were not only getting away with this, but getting away.
And still are. The bomber is still on the loose. No one has ever, that's one of our other charges, one of the charges, it won't be coming up tomorrow, but one of the charges in the lawsuit is that that there's never been a fair investigation, that when they couldn't pin the bombing on me and Daryl, they basically just abandoned the investigation. They used it to investigate Earth First, but they never seriously tried to find the bomber. For example, before the bombing, right leading up to it, I had received a series of very frightening written death threats. And we have turned over the originals of the death threats to the FBI, and there are definite leads that could be followed from these death threats. And yet, there they sit, pristine, untouched. They've never been fingerprinted, they've never been examined, and the FBI has refused to follow leads that could lead to any suspect except for an activist or myself or Daryl.
Do you suspect someone or some group?
Well, you know, I've been unable to find that out because the FBI possesses all the evidence and they won't give it to us, and no police agency has been willing to investigate. What I do know is that the timber industry very actively set me up for this bombing and that the FBI arrived within minutes and arrested me for it. So I know who set me up and I know who framed me, but I don't know who put the bomb in my car.
Judy Berry, explain what was happening that summer. You said you were going to Redwood Summer, but who were you fighting against?
Well, there are several multinational timber companies that own virtually all of the redwoods up here in California, and they're just cutting them as fast as they can. So Redwood Summer, it was actually originally called Mississippi Summer in the California Redwoods, and it was based on the historic concept of Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And what we decided was that there was a lot of violence going on against the activists and just horrendous cutting, clear cutting going on here. And we thought that with our small rural population, we could never beat them. But if we invited people, students and others from all over the country to come to California and engage in nonviolent actions to save the redwoods, that with the eyes of the nation on us, then we could tip the balance. So that's what Redwood Summer was. It was a nationwide call for people to come and engage in nonviolent actions. And people did. Despite the bombing, despite the charges of terrorism, 3,000 people came and stood up to it all with nonviolence and with principle. And this has now led to this year's struggle to save Headwaters Forest. So the movement kind of really took off in 1990. That's when it really became a mass movement up here in California.
This lawsuit, what are you suing for?
What are we trying to get from it?
Yes.
Well, we're of course, when you sue, you have to sue for money, and so we're suing them for about $1 zillion. I don't know exactly how much because it's so abstract to me, but it's definitely we're asking multi-million-dollar lawsuit.
And them is the FBI and the Oakland Police?
From the FBI and the Oakland Police. And we're also asking for an injunction to stop them from doing this. It's not just that we want justice for ourselves, certainly, but we want the FBI to be restrained from being able to do this kind of political sabotage that they're so famous for and have been doing for so long. We want them to not be able to treat activists this way.
It has been 6 years. You talked about being unconscious in a hospital bed with your pelvis shattered. What has happened to you since the bombing and because of the bombing?
Well, I was crippled for life by the bombing. There's no way I can even describe the impact. It completely changed my life. My backbone was shattered and dislocated. I ended up miraculously with only 1 foot paralyzed. I was not expected to walk, but I have extreme nerve damage, and I have limited ability to sit, walk, and stand. It also, I was never naive. I've been an activist for 25 years, but I never saw anything so close up as this. I never saw the way that the FBI have read about it before, but to see the absolute, just the absolute lack of morals, the way that they'll come in and you know, just use any kind of disinformation, any kind of force to disrupt a movement. It's been really an eye-opener for me, and it's really, I guess that was the end of innocence, was 1990. So it kind of catapulted me into a position that I never expected to be in. And since that time, I've spent a very lot of my time learning how to do paralegal work, learning how the legal system works, and trying to obtain justice in this case.
Do you think you will see justice in your lifetime in this case?
I wish I could say yes, but I can't. The FBI's lawyer has openly bragged that he intends to draw this case out for 20 years, and I don't really have that much faith in the courts. I think that there's more likely to be justice in the court of public opinion, and I think in a way we've already achieved that. The bombing in 1990 was designed to discredit Earth First as a bunch of terrorists so that we wouldn't be effective, so that people wouldn't participate in events, and in fact, we've really overcome that. From being on the front page of the New York Times as terrorists who blew ourselves up with our own bombs in 1990, and now in 1996, we were able to lead, I think, the largest civil disobedience in one day in U.S. history, 1,033 people to committing a civil disobedience in one day. I think in a large way, we really have already achieved that. I think there's very few people in our community to think that we bombed ourselves. So in a way, we have achieved justice, but the courts there's not much justice in the courts.
Judy, one last question. That's about your lawyer and the prosecutors in the case. Some interesting parallels to the 1960s.
Well, actually, the whole case, not just the lawyers either, the man who's in charge of the FBI in San Francisco at the time when I was bombed and framed, his name is Richard Held. And Richard Held was a longtime COINTELPRO operative under J. Edgar Hoover. And he was personally responsible for the framing and jailing of Black Panther Geronimo Pratt, for example. He was involved in the framing and jailing of Leonard Peltier. And he has a very long history of using this kind of political sabotage. So, that's one aspect of it. And that's one of the things we're saying in the case, is that although COINTELPRO was outlawed supposedly in 1975 after Senate hearings.
And that's the counterintelligence program of the
FBI.
That's
right. That was outlawed in 1975 after the Senate hearings declared it to violate people's constitutional rights. What we found is that the FBI has never stopped using these tactics, and they're still using them against activists today. My lawyer, Dennis Cunningham, my lead attorney in this case, also has a long history. He came out of the Chicago People's Law Office back in the 60s, and he represented Fred Hampton, Black Panther member who was killed in the FBI COINTELPRO operation. He also represented the Attica brothers and some other well-known movement cases. So both sides here, we go way back. One last thought is that, Richard Jewell was just an innocent bystander. He was just swept up in the FBI, in an FBI investigation because he happened to be there, and he's all over the news. Everybody's darling, and the FBI's apologizing to him. in my case, I was specifically targeted as a political activist, and in this case, the press doesn't want to hear anything about it.
Well, we certainly do. We want to thank you very much, Judy Barry, for being with us. We will continue to follow your case. And I should let our audience know that Judy was just diagnosed with advanced breast cancer that has metastasized to her liver, and we wish you the best. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up, we're going to talk to the new head of the American Public Health Association. Then we go down about 2.5 hours beyond San Antonio, Texas, to talk with Larry Bensky and Ronnie Duggar of the Alliance, the progressive populist movement that is shaping up. They're having their founding convention this weekend. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This week in New York City, the American Public Health Association elected a new president. His name is Dr. Quentin Young, and he's one of the nation's strongest advocates for a Canadian-style single-payer health care system for this country, a system in which all Americans would have the basic right to decent health care regardless of their economic situation. I caught up with him yesterday just after the results of the election were announced. He actually will not become president for another year. He remains the president-elect all through 1997. But I caught up with him outside the Rainbow Room at Rockefeller Center. He thought he was going to be having lunch with Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, who had just addressed the APHA, but she went back for a cabinet meeting to Washington. And this is what he had to say about his plans once he becomes president.
Well, the program of the APHA is spectacular. If for 124 years this organization has been the defender of the public's health, and that's no small statement, because we all know that in terms of life expectancy doubling in the last century and a half, and quality of life, as insofar as health interventions count, it's the public sector that did it, where it was the separation of the sewage from the drinking water, mass immunization, good prenatal and postnatal care. Those are all public health achievements. And the public, I think, knows, but needs to know better, how vital the public sector is, because it is under siege, like so many of our agencies. It's under severe budgetary crunch. And this is a phenomenon that goes from national right down to the local city health departments. We have to make sure that the public's will for good health is translated into adequate support for these programs. Another threat I see is privatization, actual taking over by for-profit enterprise of labs and other health functions, which I feel, and I think the agency feels, would be a very reactionary step backward.
Can you talk a little more about that? Because I don't think this is something that's covered very much in the media, because it is a corporate media as well.
Well, we're in a frenzy of marketplace solutions, and there's quotation marks and italics in that word, solutions, to the healthcare needs. America stands alone among the nations in the world in deciding that you could, through the marketplace, get quality, equity, and care for 270 million people. It doesn't work. Marketplace solutions result since this goal is to maximize profits, in intensifying all of the national problems, whether it's the 40 million unemployed, which has grown since this market solution came forward and will continue to grow because the prudent manager of a for-profit firm avoids sick people and very carefully markets to make that happen. That's not an idle prediction. That's everyday life. In addition, they ratchet down, under the guise of prudence and cost-effectiveness, services. They do such egregious things as put gags on the doctors and other providers, not to describe alternative care or make any criticism of the plan. This is un-American, and American people want choice. They want to feel happy, comfortable, optimistic when they're in a healthcare provider situation, not skeptical, frightened, and feeling exploited, which is a growing sense. This is why I'm optimistic about the goals of this association becoming national policy.
Dr. Young, I saw you at the Democratic National Convention outside protesting, trying to get the attention of the delegates demanding single payer. Can you talk about that?
I certainly can. We had to go to the court to get justification for being in proximity of the convention. And our concern was the end, for the first time in 48 years, of universal health care in the Democrat platform. Now, platform is puffery. It's wish list. It's campaign oratory. But it also is a statement of hope. To take it out after 48 years, we felt, was a retrogression that was not to be tolerated.
Explain exactly what was in the platform.
Well, what was in the platform was an appeal for increased access, improving quality of care, but no, not even the word universal. I'm smart enough to know that's not the end of the world because a phrase was changed. But it's highly symbolic of our plight. The president's finest hour in health for me is when he stood up before the Congress in 1994 and pulled out his pen and said, I will sign nothing you send me that isn't universal. That was his charge to the Congress. Now he tells, symbolically, the American people, that's beyond our reach. We don't buy that. We think the $1 trillion spent on health care, the vast plant, the fabulous professional and technical people that make up the health workforce can give the American people what they deserve, the best health system in the world. Right now, they don't have it, and they want it. So this organization has been committed to this for a long time now. We are players in the sense of 124 years of service has earned us a place at the table, both in the minds of the American people and in the public debate.
One of Bob Dole's major points as a candidate against President Clinton in this past election was that Clinton supported a government takeover of health care. Now, President Clinton has certainly backed off what he was even asking for at the time, which wasn't a government takeover. But can you talk about what single payer is and what it is you support?
Bob Dole is cynical. I have to believe he's smart enough to know that's campaign oratory and the most despicable sort. Single-payer national health insurance is just that. It organizes, like Social Security or Medicare, government collection of the costs of the program and government payment for it. That's a very important, simple measure. The government does nothing more than that. And in sharp contrast, in running away from government control, we ran into the arms of corporation that gives all doctors and all patients the postgraduate course in control. Control that's ruthless, profit-motivated, and not subject to the democratic controls that government is. I'm not a big buff for big government. I just know that the Canadian system is the most popular health system in the world. It could teach us many lessons, and they do it for 40% less per capita than we spend in this country for our impaired system. The American people always poll out as favoring national health insurance of the type I've described. We have to translate that into political reality, even in this reactionary period. I think it's the wedge issue, social justice issue. It's more responsive to masses of people than any other urgent issues.
I didn't hear Donna Shalala today, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, talking about single payer, although she did ask for applause if people wanted to share their applause when someone raised the issue.
Well, she's historically, there's a record. Donna Shalala has always encouraged the single payers during the president program, saying that she needed to have an expression from the left to match the vast forces on the right, notably the healthcare industry spokespersons, hospitals, insurance companies, and investors. So that's the history of that. It is a matter of fact, indeed, in the protests we talked about that I participated in, she has stopped saying universal as of February 1996. Her speech is up till then, had it. Since then, this is not a figure of speech. It was reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I guess in line with government policy, she is, after all, a spokesperson for the government, and I respect that. But it just makes more intense the need we in APHA and the American people in general, and I might add the labor movement. We were graced by Mr. Sweeney, who indicated a desire to have a pact, a collaboration with the public health system, workers, and his own unions in their effort to rejuvenate an ailing labor movement. I think he recognizes that while labor's primary interest is improving the conditions of their members, right along with it, and ultimately, I would argue, the determinant of the dignity and status and strength of the labor movement, it's its ability to offer the nation social justice. It's a fact that all of the public health systems in the world, which means every country in the world but us, were achieved through the labor movement, first and foremost. They were the vanguard, the leader. And it won't happen here until labor is fully supportive. And we're counting on Mr. Sweeney to be moving in that direction.
So he came here to the American Public Health Association meeting.
He came to our very first meeting. It's interesting. We started with him and we ended with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, two key players. But our work is cut out for us.
Explain what that work would be. What do you see the strategy of the American Public Health Association and perhaps AFL-CIO in really spearheading this, something that was not even considered, basically, by the corporate media when the whole healthcare discussion was going on 2 years ago, perhaps because they were so threatened by it?
Well, our strategy, after a campaign to get elected, I feel I have a sense of the membership and the leadership, this organization has superb policies. To put it as a quip, I've never seen a resolution they passed I didn't like. I'm not quite as complimentary about the implementation. I think that's felt across the board here. We are organized according to sections in 20 different disciplines in public health, like public health, nursing, medical care, etc. And then we have affiliates in every state in the nation, indeed two in California and two in New York. These affiliates are on-the-ground health workers. They are enormous sources of expertise and strength in all the arenas where social change are debated. I mean before legislative committees, I mean before the health professions themselves, the media. All of these avenues and venues are out there for us. It's my sense, and certainly I campaigned on this and won, that we must upgrade our efforts in that direction by several cubits. We're located in Washington, but we're also located throughout the nation. We're going to be, I think, very important players in the growing mood of the American people to get back on a caring system.
But you weren't even inside the Democratic Convention. You were outside, and it was hard for people even to hear what you were shouting to the delegates.
Well, you know, I have an anecdote to tell. The Chicago police, who were so reviled in 1968, and we were there too, as we made our last walk after 96 hours, the city in its attempt to minimize us had a police detail march us in and out of that area where we protested. The policeman said, "Doc, did you think you'd do any good?" I said, "Sure I did, but, you know, these are Democrats. They believe in what we're saying." He said, "We sure got to do something about single payer. Those corporations are eating us up." I love that as a as an epilogue for the whole 96-hour vigil. We involved 150 people. All of us were energized. And to answer your question directly, we can consider that the low point within the popular Democratic Party movement for health care reform. And everything's going to be up from here.
You not only have corporations putting pressure on Congress, you have Congress members themselves, senators like Senator Frist from Tennessee,
yes,
who actually owns a health care corporation himself, one of the largest in the country.
Yes. Well, the Senate, that exclusive club, is becoming even more exclusive, as most of its members are millionaires many times over often. That's a very dispiriting fact. And I think it's not clear, particularly after the avalanche of high-cost media buys that defined most of the congressional and certainly the presidential race, whether representative government, as envisioned by our founders in a revolution, let us remind ourselves, against monarchy and oppression, whether it can survive this newest threat to discourse and representing popular will. As a person advocating rational, decent health care, which every poll shows the American people want, I have to be thoughtful about the ability of the powerful groups to subvert in most subversive ways. So I would not answer yes if somebody said, are you sure everything's going to turn out all right? But I would say it's a struggle that represents the public's will, and it's winnable. I'm struck, just to deviate to make my point, with how quickly Jesse Jackson was able to transform the hateful result of the California primary on affirmative action, mainly in the public sector, where the strength was greater under law, to how quickly Jackson was able to attack the most powerful corporations and bring them to their knees on this very important issue. It means to me there's energies that we have to tap into. And I feel optimistic that if we make the message to the American people clear and increasingly make the price of being a congressperson or a legislator in the state yes on decent health reform, and we can do it, we'll turn the country around. And that won't be just health. Health is the wedge issue that embraces everybody. We're looking to all the other social justice issues which are linked, ecology, environment, infrastructure, all these dreadful questions, education, are not that far away from health.
Last question. How does the American Public Health Association differ from the American Medical Association?
Substantially. The AMA has a very long and powerful role in health policy and is extremely reactionary. The good news is, because of the tumult and turmoil in the field of medicine, doctors have had, in large numbers, a real concern about what's happening, and it's causing them to have new thoughts about their, shall we say, basically conservative and reactionary stance. So, but they are still far different from APHA. APHA has an unbroken record of public service in the nature of what they do. They work in health-enhancing agencies in every part of the country. The good news is that there has been initiative just this year to bring the two disciplines together. I'm hopeful that this could bear fruit, because it's not appropriate for us to be separated or antagonistic. We are very much concerned that bear fruit, and that we together, all the health professionals and health workers, work in as large a unified coalition as possible to stem the tide of corporate takeover.
You think you can get the AMA to support single payer?
Well, it's already starting. The District of Columbia, which has state presence in the AMA hierarchy, has voted to consider single payer as an option. In my own state of Illinois, there's a resolution on its way through. I can't promise it'll pass, but it would be unthinkable just 2-3 years ago to even have any hearing at all. A single payer, for us advocates, has ceased to be the best answer. It's now become the only answer. If you think it through, the only way to stem the tide of corporate takeovers is to establish a single-payer system with the collections and payments through the government that would exclude for-profit venture capital, which we've had an experiment in that. This is the way I like to put it. We've had our experiment with marketplace solutions. It's a failure. bring an end to this experiment before it does more damage.
Dr. Quentin Young, he's the new head of the American Public Health Association, elected yesterday. He takes power in 1998. We were sitting outside the Rainbow Room where he was expecting to have lunch with the Health and Human Services Secretary, Donna Shalala. I had hoped I could ask her the question that that Quentin Young, the issue he raised, and that was that she has dropped the word universal from her speeches when she talks about health care. Oh, well. I'll ask her another time when she shows up to one of those lunches. Well, coming up next, we're going to go down to Texas to the founding convention of the Alliance. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we're still looking for your comments and suggestions for a new tagline for Democracy Now!, now that it's after the elections and it's not a grassroots election show anymore. You can call us on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. By the way, on Monday, we're going to be taking a look back 10 years to the day that Edwin Meese, the attorney general at the time, announced the Iran-Contra scandal. We'll be joined by Lawrence Walsh, the former Iran-Contra prosecutor. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It all started in August 1995 when Texas Observer founding editor Ronnie Duggar wrote a piece for The Nation magazine called Real Populists, Please Stand Up. The column called for citizens to rekindle a progressive populist movement in this country to challenge corporate power and reclaim democracy. Thousands of people responded to Duggar's call, and so began the Alliance, a network of grassroots discussion, strategy, and action groups around the country. This weekend, hundreds of Alliance members are gathering on a ranch outside San Antonio, Texas, for their founding convention. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is there, and he joins us now by telephone, along with Ronnie Duggar and Annie Baker, who is a Bozeman, Montana community organizer and an Alliance member. Well, Larry,
hi, Amy.
You lucky dog there on the ranch, riding horses, relaxing.
Hi,
Ronnie.
I feel more like a horse that's ridden.
I don't think there'll be much horseback riding going on here. They've got three full days of meetings to try to define a name, a mission statement, a constitution, and bylaws, and we have something like 250 people who've come from about 30 states so far, so it's clear that Ronnie Duggar's year-long organizing efforts based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, have begun to bear fruit. And I think for our Pacifica listeners, Ronnie, maybe the first thing we should try to define is what exactly is this alliance? Because I myself am not totally clear about it. You have clearly here from the people I've met and seen and what I know about them so far, people who have been active politically in the past and represent in some cases Green Party activists, in some cases Labor Party activists, New Party, etc. Is this kind of a super group of people who are on the progressive side of the political spectrum?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think of it as a super group, and I hope there never is one. No, it's something based on the predicate, Larry, that we don't have any democracy, that the democracy has been occupied by the corporations, by the international corporate oligarchy, too, that self-government is effectively dead on important matters in the United States, and that, therefore, we have to start again. What do we do to get self-government back, and what do we do to end the corporate domination of our lives, our work, our pensions, our all the decisions that we seem to used to make for ourselves. So it's essentially a nonviolent democratic rebellion. Now, one reason there is not clarity about what it is because there shouldn't be clarity about what it is. We have 45 alliances meeting disparately around the country, many forming, two or three had formed. I hadn't heard about until I heard last night that they had formed. Beyond that, this is the National Founding Convention. We, in the sense of we the delegates, are the ones who can answer your question. If I go to answering that question, where's democracy?
Well, but you're one rather key person in this, having written the, might we call you the Moses, maybe you won't get to the Promised Land, but you do have the tablets in your hand. What would be the ideal outcome for you Sunday night that would make you feel best?
The ideal outcome would be that nobody here had the Ten Commandments in hand. The ideal outcome would be if we first have a solid and inventively democratic organization, starting with the premise that most organizations become run by cliques, including most of the progressive and left organizations. They are run by a small group, most of them, by a small group at the top, and then there's a similitude of representative democracy. I'd like us to invent some way out of that. So we have what we try to call in the Alliance horizontal communication. The second main thing is that we come out with a clear focus of strategy. When you look at this enormous international corporate oligarchy, our unique work, our special work, is to figure out a way to get handles on that elephant that are effective. And the alternative thing we're emphasizing here, and we're all through the workshops, is that we want to take our own economic lives back. We want to go into worker-owned businesses. We want to go into much more of the co-op movement. We want alternate currencies, much more withdrawing. There was a woman I was talking to today. She's here in Texas. She's a conservative woman. She says there's 70,000 people in Texas who have pulled out of the public schools. Now, that's pretty chilling to somebody, you know, but she says we're not racist. She said she's not. She doesn't. They've plugged out of television. It's that plugging out of an international corporate-dominated system which is broadly appealing to a large number of people, including people who have a lot of disagreements.
Ronnie, wherever I go and speak, people ask me about the corporate charter movement, about Richard Grossman. How is that connected to what you're doing, this idea that that people are working with around the country, that charters can be revoked from corporations that do the wrong thing?
Well, that's the program on corporations, law, and democracy, and it is deeply connected with me personally and my thinking, particularly Richard Grossman, who I think is one of the great and creative spirits in this country on social organization. The PACLAD is also its own organization. It is not a membership organization. It is a reflective organization rethinking the corporation. We have two people deeply associated with PACLAD here who are conducting with us a discussion on corporate strategy. But the Alliance is quite independent of PACLAD and any other group in terms of developing its own strategies and tactics and goals. What we hope to do, Amy, is to foster the idea in this center of this analysis that democracy is the value that corporations have rotted out. In the center of that value, we'd like to have either formally or quasi-formally a grouping of strategic partners who work together doing their own thing. And the Alliance fundamentally is putting forward the idea of coalitions in actions so that every organization keeps its integrity and its independent directions, but we come together instead of continuing to destroy each other so that people get credit for the work being done.
Ronnie, you gave the nominating speech for Ralph Nader, I believe, at the...
A more accurate way of saying that is that five of us gave a nominating speech for Nader, and another one is here, Dan Hamburg, the congressman from California,
right,
who went green. But then I was honored to present Nader to the Greens convention. Right.
You were the principal speaker in my mind, and we broadcast some of your remarks on Pacifica. How do you see what just happened in the last election as far as Nader's campaign relating to what you're trying to do here in Texas, founding the Alliance?
I think it was triumphant for Nader. One thing is that those of us who voted for him felt so good after the election. It wasn't like we had lost an election. We had done the right thing. We had helped build a long-term movement by voting for Nader, registering a significant dissent from the best of two evils argument. And in the second place, Nader helped build the Green Party, and the Green Party is part of a long-term movement. So at third place, Nader conducted profound educational work. His 2.5-hour speech that night is going to be a classic that we're going to be listening to in any civics class with any teacher who has a backbone for 30 or 40 years. No, it was a wonderful beginning. It was a triumph.
What do you mean when you talk about alternative currencies?
Well, the populists who started out here in the Texas Hill Country were moving toward the sub-treasury plan. When, to shorten a lot of history, the banks closed them down. The sub-treasury plan would have been a situation where the farmers in the United States were basically sending a wave off to the northeastern bankers. They were building their own currency system based on their own crops, and they were going into a scrip system. It is legal in the United States to use any currency you want to as long as it doesn't imitate the dollar. So this is another way of withdrawing from, I mean literally, the dollar or the American currency. Another way of withdrawing from what is essentially, I deeply believe this, Amy, it is a system that is organizing us to suck assets and wealth out of us up into an international oligarchy. So let's withdraw from it. That's what I think of as international, as local currencies.
Amy, Ronnie Duggar has to go now. The convention is actually just beginning, and he has a role, of course, in the proceedings that are just getting underway. Thank you very much for being with us this morning,
Ronnie,
on Pacifica, and we'll have more coverage of this next week. But
thank you both, and thank everybody listening.
Okay, and we will give the phone number. In fact, we might give it right now for how people who are interested can get in touch with the Alliance and who haven't come here to this rather obscure corner of Texas. It's 617-491-4221. That's 617-491-4221.
Larry, tell me the truth. Are you wearing a cowboy hat?
I have not a cowboy hat in my possession, but the weekend is not over yet. Nor a horse. But as I say, you know, horse rustling has been a long and popular tradition around here as well. Joining us right now is Annie Baker, Amy, whom you mentioned before at the top of the show. She is a political activist who has recently moved to Montana from Minnesota. And I don't suppose you could say anybody's typical of the 250 or so people who've come here. And so we're not asking you, Annie, to speak in the voice of everybody who's here. But for yourself, why did you come here? What is it that attracted you so that you would make this long journey from your home to Texas?
Now, it was a long journey. My husband and I drove 1,800 miles with two dogs and a cat, but we thought it was worth it. And we've been involved in trying to work on the initial bylaws and constitution that would allow this organization to grow organically and meaningfully. And, you know, I've been an organizer for 25 years in various social justice movements. And the reason that I'm here is because I have found over the years that every time I work for social justice or peace, I run up against the same corporate wall, either in corporately controlled media that won't allow the voice of the people that are trying to get justice to come out, or in corporately controlled legislation that blocks our ability to get some social justice through. So I sat back for about a year and thought about it and decided that really coming together with people that are going to have an analysis that will get to the root of the problem and to try to reconstitute democracy in our country is really worth my effort. And so I'm trying to help this process birth in an organic manner as I can.
You know, Annie, I was just looking at the news today, and some of the news we read at the top of the hour, and you can really see there's this corporate movement or anti-corporate movement growing around the country. You've got the story about Texaco, and right now the city of Philadelphia has divested because of racism and racial discrimination, the lawsuit. There's also news that there's a congressional inquiry that's found that the Commerce Department approved the sale of American machine equipment to China
despite the fact that the equipment might be used for military rather than civilian purposes. And it's an investigation into McDonnell Douglas, which they're saying failed to inform the Commerce Department about the sale of its equipment. And it's just over and over again, we're seeing that a lot of what's behind these stories are corporations that either lied or did something dirty. And I think that this movement is really coming into even, you know, the mainstream consciousness.
Yeah, I don't have any trouble anywhere talking to anyone on the street. I was just doing some duplicating here in Kerrville to try to get some packets done for the Alliance, and had a really nice conversation with a local woman here who really had her finger on the pulse of what was wrong. I think various people's analyses of the cause of it could be different, but I don't know anybody, and she mentioned this too, she doesn't know anybody that she talks to that doesn't feel like there's something terribly wrong with our democracy, and what we're about is trying to give people a cogent analysis that they can use to work on that and give people hope that they can, again, govern themselves.
How would you see this working, Annie, when you go back to Montana? What would be the ideal outcome for you? Again, same kind of question I asked Ronnie Duggar. What would you be able to bring back from this meeting in Texas to Montana that you think might be the best possible outcome?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll come together enough and be able to communicate it enough to at least get the beginnings of a structure, an organizing structure that would be useful across the country. My own particular view on that is that it has to be in the form of perhaps affinity groups, and that's kind of what has happened spontaneously. A group of people who have an affinity, who have a concern, come together, and they have their own culture, their own background, their own concerns. They're working on their local issues, and those little groups, I think an ideal group is probably about 25 folks who can communicate well together, work on their local issues, and then inspire others who also have an affinity together to work on their own thing. So it's sort of kind of spontaneous democratic circles popping up over the country, and now our task is to figure out how to help each other out, how to communicate, and to, I think, eventually in a few years, move as one body.
Do you see
I'm hoping that we'll become an umbrella that can give a real good analysis to people that can foster their ability to act.
Do you see a political party in your future, or do you think this will remain as a movement?
I think that ultimately people will realize that all the progressive elements of the country must come together. There's a lot of really good movements politically recently that I think will figure out that they have to communicate, compromise, and form one larger body. Yes, I believe that that will happen.
You know, we have on the agenda here for this weekend some of the speakers who have been very popular in the Pacifica audience, at least in the past, including David Corton, author of When Corporations Rule the World, Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, Molly Ivins, no Texas conference would be complete without her, and Jim Hightower. And we'll be recording all of those and having all or some of them on this program in the future. There are also workshops, though, Annie, on things like the corporate systemic focus, which Amy brought up with Jane Ann Morris, who's a corporate anthropologist. That's a good title, corporate anthropologist. And also Peter Kelman of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And when a lot of people think about the corporations and their power in this country, when they think of GE or Archer Daniels Midland or whatever, they can't get a handle on how to confront these corporations. What's your take on that?
Well, I think when corporations got personhood in the 1800s, I think that was a wrong turn. I think that they aren't persons, they are organizations, and they need to be responsible to the people who own them, to the stockholders, to the shareholders, to the people that they affect, they need to be responsible to, and I think we have to correct that problem. I'm not saying that corporations as entities have to be destroyed, but I think they have to become responsible to those they affect and to those who own them. We, our money, they run on our money And we need to be able to direct them, and that needs to be corrected, I believe.
Well, Annie Baker, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Bozeman, Montana, though you are there about 2.5 hours away from San Antonio for this founding convention of the Alliance. And Larry, thanks very much for being with us. I know next week we'll be playing some of the speeches and talk with you about what happened this weekend.
Yes, we will, and I'll be joining you Monday, Amy, back in California for a very exciting program, the 10th anniversary of the announcement at the White House of the Iran-Contra memo, and I understand we're having Lawrence Walsh, the former independent counsel, on, and that's going to be a very, very hot program. I hope people will be listening.
Yeah, and we also Bob Parry will be joining us. Folks, you're listening to Democracy Now!
When the bells of tyranny ring their last, and the long dark night of oppression has passed,
what?
And the foghorn of freedom has blown its big blast. You'll be there.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our director, Brother Shine. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. As we go out with the Foremen on their CD, Folk Heroes.
Has finally been found. You'll be there. You'll be there. When all men have homes and jobs and food and an optimistic attitude.